Whatever Brinker had in his mind to do, I thought he had chosen a terrible place for it. There was nothing funny about the assembly room. I could remember staring torpidly through these windows 100 times out at the elms in the center common. The windows now had the closed blankness of night, a deadened look about them, a look of being blind or deaf. The great expanses of wall space were opaque with canvases, portraits in oil of deceased headmasters, a founder or two, forgotten leaders of the faculty, a beloved athletic coach none of us had ever heard of, a lady we could not identify, her fortune had largely rebuilt the school, a nameless poet who was thought when under the school's protection to be destined primarily for future generations, a young hero, now anonymous, who looked theatrical in the first World War uniform in which he had died. I thought any prank was bound to fall flat here. The assembly hall was used for large lectures, debates, plays, and concerts. It had the worst acoustics in the school. I couldn't make out what Brinker was saying. He stood on the polished marble floor in front of us, but facing the platform, talking to the boys behind the balustrade, I heard him say the word inquiry to them, and something about the country demands. "What is all this hot air?" I said into the blur.
"I don't know," Phineas answered shortly.
As he turned toward us, Brinker was saying,
"Blame on the responsible party. We will begin with a brief prayer."
He paused, surveying us with the kind of wide-eyed surmise Mr. Carthart always used at this point, and then added in Mr. Carthart's urbane murmur,
"Let us pray."
And we all slumped immediately and unthinkingly into the awkward crouch in which God was addressed at Devon, leaning forward with elbows on knees. Brinker had caught us, and in a moment it was too late to escape, for he had moved swiftly into the Lord's Prayer. If when Brinker had said,
"Let us pray,"
I had said, "Go to hell," everything might have been saved. At the end, there was an indecisive, semi-serious silence, and then Brinker said,
"Phineas, if you please."
Finney got up with a shrug and walked to the center of the floor, between us and the platform. Brinker got an armchair from behind the balustrade and seated Finney on it with courtly politeness.
"Now, just in your own words," he said.
"What own words?"
said Phineas, grimacing up at him with his best, "You are an idiot," expression.
"I know you haven't got many of your own," said Brinker, with a charitable smile. "Use some of Jean's, then."
"What shall I talk about? You? I've got plenty of words of my own for that."
"I'm all right."
Brinker glanced gravely around the room for confirmation.
"You're the casualty."
"Brinker,"
began Finney in a constricted voice I did not recognize,
"are you off your head or what?"
"No," said Brinker evenly. "That's Leper, our other casualty. Tonight, we're investigating you."
"What the hell are you talking about?"
I cut in suddenly.
"Investigating Finney's accident."
He spoke as though it was the most natural and self-evident and inevitable thing we could be doing. I felt the blood flooding into my head.
"After all," he continued, "there is a war on. Here's one soldier our side has already lost. We've got to find out what happened."
"Just for the record," said someone from the platform, "you agree, don't you, Gene?"
"I told Brinker this morning,"
I began in a voice treacherously shaking,
"that I thought this was the worst."
"And I said,"
Brinker's voice was full of authority and perfectly under control,
"that for Finney's good,"
and with an additional timbre of sincerity,
"and for your own good too, by the way, Gene, that we should get all of this into the open. We don't want any mysteries or any stray rumors and suspicions left in the air at the end of the year, do we?"
A collective assent to this rumbled through the blurring atmosphere of the assembly room.
"What are you talking about?"
Finney's voice was full of contemptuous music.
"What rumors and suspicions?"
"Never mind about that,"
said Brinker, with his face responsibly grave. He's enjoying this, I thought bitterly. He's imagining himself justice incarnate, balancing the scales. He's forgotten that justice incarnate is not only balancing the scales, but also blindfolded.
"Why don't you just tell us in your words what happened?" Brinker continued. "Just humor us, if you want to think of it that way.
We aren't trying to make you feel bad. Just tell us."
"You know we wouldn't ask if we didn't have a good reason."
"Good reasons?" "There's nothing to tell."
"Nothing to tell?"
Brinker looked pointedly at the small cast around Finney's lower leg and cane he held between his knees.
"Well, then, I fell out of a tree."
"Why?"
said someone on the platform. The acoustics were so bad and the light so dim that I could rarely tell who was speaking,
except for Finney and Brinker, who were isolated on the wide strip of marble floor between us in the seats and the others on the platform.
"Why?"
repeated Phineas.
"Because I took a wrong step."
"Did you lose your balance?"
continued the voice.
"Yes,"
echoed Finney grimly. "I lost my balance."
"You had better balance than anyone in the school."
"Thanks a lot."
"I didn't say it for a compliment."
"Well then, no thanks."
"Have you ever thought that you didn't just fall out of that tree?"
This touched an interesting point Phineas had been turning over in his mind for a long time. I could tell that because the obstinate, competitive look left his face as his mind became engaged for the first time.
"It's very funny," he said. "But ever since then, I've had a feeling that the tree did it by itself. It's an impression I've had. Almost as though the tree shook me out by itself."
The acoustics in the assembly room were so poor that silences there had a heavy hum of their own.
"Someone else was in the tree, is that so?"
"No,"
said Finney spontaneously. "I don't think so." He looked at the ceiling.
"Or was there? Maybe there was somebody climbing up the rungs of the trunk. I kind of forget."
This time the hum of silence was prolonged to a point where I would be forced to fill it with some kind of sound if it didn't end. Then, someone else on the platform spoke up.
"I thought somebody told me Gene Forrester was..."
"Finney was there,"
Brinker interrupted commandingly.
"He knows better than anyone."
"You were there too, weren't you, Gene?"
this new voice from the platform continued.
"Yes,"
I said with interest.
"Yes, I was there too."
"Were you near the tree?"
Finney turned toward me.
"You were down at the bottom, weren't you?"
he asked. Not in the official courtroom tone he had used before, but in a friend's voice. I had been studying very carefully the way my hands wrinkled when tightly clenched, but I was able to bring my head up and return his inquiring look.
"Down at the bottom. Yes."
Finney went on.
"Did you see the tree shake or anything?"
He flushed faintly at what seemed to him the absurdity of his own question.
"I've always meant to ask you, just for the hell of it."
I took this under consideration.
"I don't recall anything like that."
"Nutty question,"
he muttered.
"I thought you were in the tree,"
the platform voice cut in.
"Well, of course," said Finney in an exasperated chuckle. "Of course I was in the tree. Oh, you mean Gene. He wasn't in... Is that what you mean, or—"
Finney floundered with muddled honesty between me and my questioner.
"I meant Gene,"
the voice said.
"Of course Finney was in the tree,"
I said. But I couldn't make the confusion last.
"And I was down at the bottom, or climbing the rungs, I think."
"How do you expect him to remember?"
said Finney sharply.
"There was a hell of a lot of confusion right then."
"A kid I used to play with was hit by a car once when I was about 11 years old," said Brinker seriously, "and I remember every single thing about it. Exactly where I was standing, the color of the sky, the noise the brakes of the car made. I never will forget anything about it."
"You and I are two different people," I said.
"No one's accusing you of anything,"
Brinker responded in an odd tone.
"Well, of course no one's accusing me."
"Don't argue so much."
His voice tried for a hard compromise, full of warning and yet striving to pass unnoticed by the others.
"No, we're not accusing you,"
a boy on the platform said evenly. And then I stood accused.
"I think I remember now,"
Finney broke in, his eyes bright and relieved.
"Yes, I remember seeing you standing on the bank. You were looking up, and your hair was plastered down over your forehead so that you had that dumb look you always have when you've been in the water. What was it you said? Stop posing up there, or one of those best pal cracks you were always making."
He was very happy.
"And I think I started to pose just to make you madder, and I said, what did I say? Something about the two of us. Yes, I said, let's make a double jump. Because I thought if we went together, it would be something that had never been done before. Holding hands in a jump."
Then it was though somebody had suddenly slapped him.
"No. That was on the ground when I said that to you. I said that to you on the ground. And then the two of us started to climb."
He broke off.
"The two of you," the boy on the platform went on harshly, "started to climb the tree together. Was that it? And he's just said he was on the ground." "Or on the rungs," I burst in. "I said I might have been on the rungs."
"Who else was there?" said Brinker quietly. "Leper Lepellier was there, wasn't he?"
"Yes," someone said. "Leper was there."
"Leper always was the exact type when it came to details," continued Brinker. "He could have told us where everybody was standing, what everybody was wearing, the whole conversation that day, and what the temperature was. He could have cleared the whole thing up. Too bad."
No one said anything. Phineas had been sitting, motionless, leaning slightly forward, not far from the position in which we prayed at Devon. After a long time, he turned and reluctantly looked at me. I did not return his look, or move, or speak. And then, at last, Finney straightened from this prayerful position slowly, as though it was painful for him.
"Leper's here,"
he said, in a voice so quiet and with such quiet, unconscious dignity, that he was suddenly terrifyingly strange to me. "I saw him go into Dr. Carhart's office this morning."
"Here? Go get him,"
said Brinker immediately to the two boys who had come with us.
"He must be in Carhart's rooms if he hasn't gone back home."
I kept quiet. To myself, however, I made a number of swift automatic calculations. That Leper was no threat. No one would ever believe Leper. Leper was deranged. He was not of sound mind, and if people couldn't make out their wills when they're not in sound mind, certainly they couldn't testify in something like this. The two boys left, and the atmosphere immediately cleared. Action had been taken, so the whole issue was dropped for now. Someone began making fun of Captain Marvel, the head of the football team, saying how girlish he looked in his graduation gown. Captain Marvel minced for us in his size 12 shoes, the sides of his gown swaying drunkenly back and forth from his big hips. Someone wound himself in the folds of the red velvet curtain and peered out from it like an exotic spy. Someone made a long speech listing every infraction of the rules we were committing that night. Someone else made a speech showing how, by careful planning, we could break all the others before dawn. But although the acoustics in the assembly hall were poor, those outside the room were admirable. All the talk and horseplay ended within a few seconds of the instant when the first person, that is myself, heard the footsteps returning along the marble stairway and corridors toward us. I knew, with absolute certainty, moments before they came in, that there were three sets of footsteps coming. Leper entered ahead of the other two. He looked unusually well. His face was glowing, his eyes were bright, his manner was all energy.
"Yes?"
he said in a clear voice, resonant even in this room.
"What can I do for you?"
He made this confident remark almost, but not quite, to Phineas, who was still sitting alone in the middle of the room. Finney muttered something which was too indecisive for Leper, who turned with a cleanly energetic gesture toward Brinker. Brinker began talking to him in the elaborate, casual manner of someone being watched. Gradually, the noise in the room, which had revived when the three of them came in, subsided again. Brinker managed it. He never raised his voice, but instead he let the noise surrounding it gradually sink so that his voice emerged in the ensuing silence without any emphasis on his part.
"So that you were standing next to the riverbank, watching Phineas climb the tree," he was saying, and waited, I knew, until this silence to say.
"Sure. Right there by the trunk of the tree. I was looking up. It was almost sunset, and I remember the way the sun was shining in my eyes. So you couldn't..."
I began before I could stop myself. There was a short pause, during which every ear and no eyes were directed toward me. And then Brinker went on.
"And what did you see? Could you see anything with the sun in your eyes?"
"Oh, sure,"
said Leper in his new, confident, false voice.
"I just shaded my eyes a little, like this."
He demonstrated how a hand shades the eyes.
"And then I could see. I could see both of them clearly enough because the sun was blazing all around them."
A certain sing-song sincerity was developing in his voice, as though he were trying to hold the interest of young children.
"And the rays of the sun were shooting past them, millions of rays shooting past them like golden machine gun fire."
He paused to let us consider this profoundly revealing exactness of this phrase.
"That's what it was like, if you want to know. The two of them looked as black as death, standing up there with this fire burning all around them."
Everyone could hear, couldn't they? The derangement in his voice? Everyone must be able to see how false his confidence was. Any fool could see that.
But whatever I said would be a self-indictment. Others would have to fight for me.
"Up there where?" said Brinker brusquely. "Where were the two of them standing up there?"
"On the limb."
Lepers annoyed, this is obvious tone, would discount what he said in their minds. They would know that he had never been like this before. He had changed and was not responsible.
"Who was where on the limb? Was one of them ahead of the other?"
"Well, of course."
"Who was ahead?"
Leper smiled waggishly.
"I couldn't see that. They were just two shapes. And with that fire shooting past them, they looked as black as..."
"You've already told us that. You couldn't see who was ahead?"
"No, naturally I couldn't."
"But you could see how they were standing. Where were they exactly?"
"One of them was next to the trunk, holding the trunk of the tree. I'll never forget that because the tree was a huge black shape, too. And his hand touching the black trunk anchored him, if you see what I mean, to something solid in all the bright fire they were standing in up there. And the other one was a little farther out on the limb."
"Then what happened?"
"Then they both moved."
"How did they move?"
"They moved."
Now Limper was smiling, a charming and slightly arch smile, like a child who knows he is going to say something clever.
"They moved like an engine."
In the baffled silence, I began to uncoil slowly.
"Like an engine?"
Brinker's expression was a struggle between surprise and disgust.
"I can't think of the name of the engine, but it has two pistons. What is that engine? Well, anyway, in this engine, first one piston sinks, and then the next one sinks. The one holding onto the trunk sank for a second, up and down like a piston, and then the other one sank and fell."
Someone on the platform exclaimed,
"The one who moved first shook the other one's balance."
"I suppose so."
Leper seemed to be rapidly losing interest.
"Was the one who fell," Brinker said slowly, "was Phineas, in other words, the one who moved first or second?"
Leper's face became guileful, his voice flat, impersonal.
"I don't intend to implicate myself. I'm no fool, you know. I'm not going to tell you everything and then have it used against me later. You always did take me for a fool, didn't you? But I'm no fool anymore. I know when I have information that might be dangerous."
He was working himself up to indignation.
"Why should I tell you? Just because it happens to suit you?"
"Leper,"
Brinker pleaded.
"Leper, this is very important."
"So am I,"
he said thinly.
"I'm important. You've never realized it, but I'm important, too. You be the fool.
He gazed shrewdly at Brinker.
You do whatever anyone wants, whenever they want it. You be the fool now, bastard.
Phineas had gotten up, unnoticed, from his chair.
I don't care,
he interrupted in an even voice, so full of richness that it overrode all the others.
I don't care.
I tore myself from the bench toward him. Phineas! He shook his head sharply, closing his eyes, and then he turned to regard me with a handsome mask of face.
I just don't care. Never mind.
And he started across the marble floor toward the doors.
Wait a minute, Brinker cried. We haven't heard everything yet. We haven't got all the facts.
The words shocked Phineas into awareness. He whirled as though being attacked from behind.
You get the rest of the facts, Brinker,
he cried.
You get all your facts.
I had never seen Finney crying.
You collect every effing fact there is in the world.
And he plunged out the doors. The excellent exterior acoustics recorded his rushing steps and the quick rapping of his cane along the corridor and on the first steps of the marble stairway. Then, these separate sounds collided into the general tumult of his body falling clumsily down the white marble stairs. Chapter 12. Everyone behaved with complete presence of mind. Brinker shouted that Phineas must not be moved. Someone else, realizing that only a night nurse would be at the infirmary, did not waste time going there, but rushed to bring Dr. Stanpole from his house. Others remembered that Phil Latham, the wrestling coach, lived just across the common, and that he was an expert in first aid. It was Phil who made Finney stretch out on one of the wide, shallow steps on the staircase, and kept him still until Dr. Stanpole arrived. The foyer and the staircase of the first building were soon as crowded as at midday. Phil Latham found the main light switch, and all the marble blazed up under full illumination. But surrounding it was the stillness of near midnight in a country town, so that the hurrying feet and the repressed voices had a hollow reverberance. The windows, blind and black, retained their look of dull emptiness. Once, Brinker turned to me and said,
"Go back to the assembly room and see if there's any kind of blanket on the platform."
I dashed up the stairs, found a blanket, and gave it to Phil Latham. He carefully wrapped it around Phineas. I would have liked very much to have done that myself. It would have meant a lot to me. But Phineas might have begun to curse me with every word he knew. He might lose his head completely. He would certainly be worse off for it. So I kept out of the way. He was entirely conscious, and from the glimpses I caught of his face, seemed to be fairly calm. Everyone behaved with complete presence of mind, and that included Phineas. When Dr. Stanpole arrived, there was silence on the stairs. Wrapped tightly in his blanket, with light flooding down on him from the chandelier, Finney lay isolated in the center of a tight circle of faces. The rest of the crowd looked on from above or below on the stairs, and I stood on the lower edge. Behind me, the foyer was now empty. After a short, silent examination, Dr. Stanpole had a chair brought from the assembly room, and Finney was lifted cautiously into it. People aren't ordinarily carried in chairs in New Hampshire, and as they raised him up, he looked very strange to me, like some tragic and exalted personage, a stricken pontiff. Once again, I had the desolating sense of having all along ignored what was finest in him. Perhaps it was just the incongruity of seeing him aloft and stricken, since he was by nature someone who carried others. I didn't think he knew how to act or even how to feel as the object of help. He went past with his eyes closed and his mouth tense. I knew that normally I would have been one of those carrying the chair, saying something into his ear as we went along. My aid alone had never seemed to him in the category of help. The reason for this occurred to me as the procession moved slowly across the brilliant foyer to the doors. Phineas had thought of me as an extension of himself. Dr. Stanpole stopped near the doors, looking for the light switch. There was an interval of a few seconds when no one was near him. I came up to him and tried to phrase my question, but nothing came out. I couldn't find the word to begin. I was being torn irreconcilably between "is he" and "what is," when Dr. Stamphol, without appearing to notice my tangle, said conversationally,
"It's his leg again. Broken again. A much cleaner break, I think. Much cleaner. A simple fracture."
He found the light switch, and the foyer was plunged into darkness. Outside, the doctor's car was surrounded by boys, while Finney was being lifted inside by Phil Latham. Phil and Dr. Stanpole then got into the car and drove slowly away, the headlights forming a bright parallel as they receded down the road and then swinging into another parallel at right angles to the first as they turned into the infirmary driveway. The crowd began to thin rapidly. The faculty had at last heard that something was amiss in the night, and several alarmed and alarming masters materialized in the darkness and ordered the students to their dormitories. Mr. Ludsbury loomed abruptly out of the background of shrubbery.
"Get along to the dormitory, Forrester,"
he said with a dry certainty in my obedience, which suddenly struck me as funny. Definitely funny. Since it was beneath his dignity to wait and see if I actually followed his orders, I was, by not budging, free of him a moment later. I walked into the bank of shrubbery, circled past trees in the direction of the chapel, doubled back along a large building donated by an alumni which no one had ever been able to put to use, recrossed the street and walked noiselessly up the emerging grass next to the infirmary driveway. Dr. Stanpole's car was at the top of it, headlights on and motor running, empty. I idly considered stealing it, in the way that people idly consider many crimes it would be possible for them to commit. I took an academic interest in the thought of stealing the car, knowing all the time that it would be not so much criminal as meaningless. A lapse into nothing, an escape into nowhere. As I walked past it, the motor was throbbing with wheezing reluctance. Prep school doctors don't own very desirable getaway cars, I remembered thinking to myself. And then I turned the corner of the building and began to creep along behind it. There was only one window lighted at the far end, and opposite it, I found some thin shrubbery which provided enough cover for me to study the window. It was too high for me to see directly into the room, but after I made sure that the ground had softened enough so that I could jump without making much noise, I sprang as high as I could. I had a flashing glimpse of a door at the other end of the room, opening on the corridor. I jumped again. Someone's back. Again. Nothing new. I jumped again and saw a head and shoulders partially turned away from me. Phil Latham's. This was the room. The ground was too damp to sit on, so I crouched down and waited. I could hear their blurred voices droning monotonously through the window. If they do nothing worse, they're going to bore Finney to death, I said to myself. My head seemed to be full of bright remarks this evening. It was cold, crouching motionless next to the ground. I stood up and jumped several times, not so much to see into the room as to warm up. The only sounds were occasional snorts from the engine of Dr. Stamphol's car when it turned over with special reluctance, and a thin, lonely whistling the wind sometimes made high in the still bare trees. These formed the background for the dull hum of talk in Finney's room as Phil Latham, Dr. Stanpole, and the night nurse worked over him. What could they be talking about? The night nurse had always been the biggest windbag in the school. Miss Windbag, RN. Phil Latham, on the other hand, hardly ever spoke. One of the few things he said was,
"Give it the old college try."
He thought of everything in terms of the old college try. He had told students to attack their studies, their sports, religious waverings, sexual maladjustments, physical handicaps, and a constellation of other problems with the old college try. I listened tensely for his voice. I listened so hard that I nearly differentiated it from the others, and it seemed to be saying, "Finney, give that bone the old college try." I was quite a card tonight myself. Phil Latham's college was Harvard, although I had heard that he only lasted there a year. Probably he had tried to say to someone to give something the old college try, and that had finished him. That would probably be grounds for expulsion at Harvard. There couldn't possibly be such a thing as the old Harvard try. Could there be the old Devon try? The old Devon endeavor? The decrepit Devon endeavor? That was good. The decrepit Devon endeavor. I'd use that sometime in the butt room. That was pretty funny. I bet I could get a rise out of Finney with... Dr. Stampole was fairly gabby, too. What was he always saying? Nothing. Nothing? Well, there must be something he was always saying. Everyone had something, some word, some phrase they were always saying. The trouble with Dr. Stampole was that his vocabulary was too large. He talked in a huge circle. He probably had a million words in his vocabulary, and he had to use them all before he started over again. That's probably the way they were talking there now. Dr. Stampole was working his way as fast as possible around his big circle. Miss Windbag was gasping out something or other all the time, and Phil Latham was saying, "Give it the old college try, Finney!" Phineas, of course, was answering them only in Latin. I nearly laughed out loud at that. "Gallia est omnis, duisse in partes tres." Finney probably answered that whenever Phil Latham spoke. Phil Latham would look rather blank at that. Did Finney like Phil Latham? Yes, of course he did. But wouldn't it be funny if he suddenly turned to him and said, "Phil Latham, you're a boob." That would be funny in a way. And what about if he said, "Dr. Stampole, old pal, you're the most long-winded licensed medical man alive." And would it be even funnier if he interrupted that night nurse and said, "Miss Windbag, you're rotten, rotten to the core. I just thought I ought to tell you." It would never occur to Finney to say any of these things. But they struck me as so outrageous that I couldn't stop myself from laughing. I put my hand over my mouth. Then I tried to stop my mouth with my fist. If I couldn't get control of this laughing, they would hear me in the room. I was laughing so hard it hurt my stomach. I could feel my face getting more and more flush. I dug my teeth into my fist to try to gain control, and then I noticed there were tears all over my hand. The engine of Dr. Stampole's car roared exhaustedly. The headlights turned in an erratic arc away from me, and then I heard the engine laboriously recede into the distance. I continued to listen until not only had it ceased, but my memory of how it sounded had also ceased. The light had gone out in the room, and there was no sound coming from it. The only noise was the peculiarly bleak whistling of the wind through the upper branches. There was a streetlight behind me somewhere through the trees, and the windows of the infirmary dimly reflected it. I came up close beneath the window of Finney's room, found a foothold on the grating beneath, straightened up so that my shoulders were at a level with the windowsill, reached up with both hands, and since I was convinced that the window would be stuck shut, I pushed it hard. The window shot up. There was a startled rustling from the bed in the shadows. I whispered, "Finney!" sharply into the black room. "Who is it?" he demanded, leaning out from the bed so that the light fell waveringly on his face. Then he recognized me, and I thought at first he was going to get out of bed and help me through the window. He struggled clumsily for such a length of time that even my mind, shocked and slowed as it had been, was able to formulate two realizations: that his leg was bound so that he could not move very well, and that he was struggling to unleash his hate against me. "I came to... You want to break something else in me? Is that why you're here?" He thrashed wildly in the darkness. The bed groaned under him, and the sheets hissed as he fought against them. But he was not going to be able to get to me, because his matchless coordination was gone. He could not even get up from the bed. "I want to fix your leg up," I said crazily, but in a perfectly natural tone of voice, which made my words sound even crazier, even to me. "You'll fix my..." And he arched out, lunging hopelessly into the space between us. He arched out and then fell, his legs still on the bed, his hands falling with a loud slap against the floor. Then, after a pause, all the tension drained out of him, and he let his head come slowly down between his hands. He had not hurt himself, but he brought his head slowly down between his hands and rested it against the floor, not moving, not making any sound.
I'm sorry,
I said blindly. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I had just control enough to stay out of his room, to let him struggle back into the bed by himself. I slid down from the window, and I remember lying on the ground, staring up at the night sky, which was neither clear nor overcast. And I remember later walking alone down a rather aimless road which leads past the gym to an old waterhole. I was trying to cope with something that might be called double vision. I saw the gym in the glow of a couple of outside lights near it, and knew, of course, that it was the Devon gym which I entered every day. It was, and it wasn't. There was something innately strange about it. As though there had been an inner core to the gym which I had never perceived before. Quite different from its generally accepted appearance. It seemed to alter moment by moment before my eyes, becoming for brief flashes a totally unknown building with a significance much deeper and far more real than any I had noticed before. The same was true of the waterhole, where unauthorized games of hockey were played during the winter. The ice was breaking up now, with just a few glazed islands of ice remaining in the center and a fringe of hard surface glinting along the banks. The old trees surrounding it all were intensely meaningful, with a message that was very pressing and entirely indecipherable. Here the road turned to the left and became dirt. It proceeded along the lower end of the playing fields, and under the pale night glow, the playing fields swept away from me in slight frosty undulations, which bespoke meanings upon meanings, levels of reality I had never suspected before, a kind of thronging and epic grandeur which my superficial eyes and cluttered mind had been blind to before. They unrolled away, impervious to me, as though I were a roaming ghost, not only tonight, but always, as though I had never played on them 100 times, as though my feet had never touched them, as though my whole life at Devon had been a dream, or rather that everything at Devon, the playing fields, the gym, the waterhole, and all the other buildings and all the people there, were intensely real, wildly alive, and totally meaningful, and I alone was a dream, a figment which had never really touched anything. I felt that I was not, never had been, and never would be a living part of this overpoweringly solid and deeply meaningful world around me. I reached the bridge, which arches over the Little Devon River, and beyond it, the dirt track which curves toward the stadium. The stadium itself, 2 white concrete banks of seats, was as powerful and alien to me as an Aztec ruin, filled with the traces of vanished people and vanished rites, of supreme emotions and supreme tragedies. The old phrase about, if these walls could only speak, occurred to me, and I felt it more deeply than anyone had ever felt it. I felt that the stadium could not only speak, but that its words could hold me spellbound. In fact, the stadium did speak powerfully, and at all times, including this moment. But I could not hear, and that was because I did not exist. I woke the next morning in a dry and fairly sheltered corner of the ramp underneath the stadium. My neck was stiff from sleeping in an awkward position. The sun was high and the air freshened. I walked back to the center of the school and had breakfast, and then went to my room to get a notebook, because this was Wednesday, and I had a class at 9:10. But at the door of the room, I found a note from Dr. Stanpole. Please bring some of Finney's clothes and his toilet things to the infirmary. I took his suitcase from the corner where it had been accumulating dust and put what he would need into it. I didn't know what I was going to say at the infirmary. I couldn't escape from a confusing sense of having lived through all this before. Phineas in the infirmary. And myself responsible. I seemed to be less shocked by it now than I had the first time last August, when it had broken over our heads like a thunderclap in a flawless sky. There are hints of much worse things around us now, like a faint odor in the air, evoked by words like plasma and psycho and sulfa. Strange words like that, with endings like Latin nouns. The newsreels and magazines were choked with images of blazing artillery and bodies half sunk in the sand of a beach somewhere. We members of the class of 1943 were moving very fast toward the war now. So fast that there were casualties even before we reached it. A mind was clouded and a leg was broken. Maybe these should be thought of as minor and inevitable mishaps in the accelerated rush. The air around us was filled with much worse things. In this way, I tried to calm myself as I walked with Finney's suitcase toward the infirmary. After all, I reflected to myself, people were shooting flames into caves and grilling other people alive. Ships were being torpedoed and dropping thousands of men in the icy ocean. Whole city blocks were exploding into flame in an instant. My brief burst of animosity, lasting only a second, a part of a second, something which came before I could recognize it and was gone before I knew it had possessed me. What was that in the midst of this holocaust? I reached the infirmary with Finney's suitcase and went inside. The air was laden with hospital smells, not unlike those of the gym, except that the infirmary lacked the sense of spent human vitality. This was becoming the new background of Finney's life, this purely medical element, from which bodily health was absent. The corridor happened to be empty, and I walked along it in the grip of a kind of fatal exhilaration. All doubt had been resolved at last. There was a wartime phrase coming into style just then. This is it. And although it later became a parody of itself, it had a final flat accuracy, which was all that could be said at certain times. This was one of those times. This was it. I knocked and went in. He was stripped to the waist, sitting up in bed, leafing through a magazine. I carried my head low by instinct and had the courage for only a short glance at him before I said quietly, "I brought your stuff. Put the suitcase on the bed here, will you?" The tone of his words fell dead center, without a trace of friendliness or unfriendliness. Not interested and not bored. Not energetic and not languid. I put it down beside him, and he opened it and began to look through the extra underwear and shirts and socks I had packed. I stood precariously in the middle of the room, trying to find somewhere to look and something to say, wanting desperately to leave and powerless to do so. Phineas went carefully over his clothes, apparently very calm. But it wasn't like him to check with such care, not like him at all. He was taking a long time at it, and then I noticed that as he tried to slide a hairbrush out from under a flap holding it in the case, his hands were shaking so badly that he couldn't get it out. Seeing that released me on the spot. "Finney, I tried to tell you before. I tried to tell you when I came to Boston that time." "I know. I remember that." He couldn't, after all, always keep his voice under control. "What'd you come around here for last night?" "I don't know." I went over to the window and placed my hands on the sill. I looked down at them with a sense of detachment, as though they were hands somebody had sculpted and put on exhibition somewhere. "I had to." Then I added, with great difficulty, "I thought I belonged here." I felt him turning to look at me, and so I looked up. He had a particular expression, which his face assumed when he understood, but didn't think he should show it. A settled, enlightened look. Its appearance now was the first decent thing I had seen in a long time. He suddenly slammed his fist against the suitcase. "I wish to God there wasn't any war!" I looked sharply at him. "What made you say that?" "I don't know if I can take this with a war on. I don't know." "If you can take, what good are you in a war with a busted leg?"
"Well, you... why, there are lots. You can..."
He bent over the suitcase again.
"I've been writing to the Army and the Navy and the Marines and the Canadians and everybody else all winter. Did you know that? No, you didn't know that. I used the post office in town for my return address. They all gave me the same answer after they saw the medical report on me. The answer was no soap. We can't use you. I also wrote the Coast Guard, the Merchant Marine. I wrote to General de Gaulle personally. I also wrote Chiang Kai-shek, and I was about ready to write somebody in Russia. I made an attempt at a grin.
You wouldn't like it in Russia.
I'll hate it everywhere if I'm not in this war. Why do you think I kept saying there wasn't any war all winter? I was going to keep on saying it until 2 seconds after I got a letter from Ottawa or Chongqing or someplace saying, "Yes, you can enlist with us."
A look of pleased achievement flickered over his face momentarily, as though he had really gotten such a letter.
Then there would have been a war.
Finny.
My voice broke, but I went on.
Phineas, you wouldn't be any good in the war even if nothing had happened to your leg.
A look of amazement fell over him. It scared me, but I knew what I said was important and right, and my voice found that full tone voices have when they are expressing something long felt and long understood and released at last.
They'd get you someplace at the front and there'd be a lull in the fighting, and next thing anybody knew, you'd be over with the Germans and the Japs, asking if they'd like to field a baseball team against our side. You'd be sitting in one of their command posts, teaching them English. Yes, you'd get confused and borrow one of their uniforms, and you'd lend them one of yours. Sure, that's just what would happen. You'd get things so scrambled up, nobody would know who to fight anymore. You'd make a mess, a terrible mess, Finny, out of the war.
His face had been struggling to stay calm as he listened to me. But now he was crying, but trying to control himself.
It was just some kind of blind impulse you had in the tree there. You didn't know what you were doing. Was that it?
Yes, yes, that was it. Oh, that was it, but how can you believe that? How can you believe that? I can't even make myself pretend that you could believe that.
I do. I think I can believe that. I've gotten awful mad sometimes and almost forgotten what I was doing. I think I believe you. I think I can believe that. And that was it. Something just seized you. It wasn't anything you felt against me. It wasn't some kind of hate you felt all along. It wasn't anything personal.
No.
I don't know how to show you. How can I show you, Finny? Tell me how to show you. It was just some ignorance inside me, some crazy thing inside me, something blind. That's all it was.
He was nodding his head, his jaw tightening, and his eyes closed on the tears.
I believe you. It's okay because I understand, and I believe you. You've already shown me. And I believe you.
The rest of the day passed quickly. Dr. Stamphol had told me in the corridor that he was going to set the bone that afternoon. Come back around 5 o'clock, he had said, when Finney should be coming out of the anesthesia. I left the infirmary and went to my 10-10 class, which was on American history. Mr. Patch Withers gave us a 5-minute written quiz on the Necessary and Proper Clause of the Constitution. At 11 o'clock, I left that building and crossed the center common, where a few students were already lounging, although it was still a little early in the season for that. I went into the first building, walked up the stairs where Finney had fallen, and joined my 11-10 class, which was mathematics. We were given a 10-minute trigonometry problem, which appeared to solve itself on my paper. At 12, I left the first building, recrossed the common, and went into the Jared Potter building for lunch. We had breaded veal cutlet, spinach, mashed potatoes, and prune whip. At the table, we discussed whether there was any saltpeter in the mashed potatoes. I defended the negative. After lunch, I walked back to the dormitory with Brinker. He alluded to last night only by asking how Phineas was. I said he seemed to be in good spirits. I went on to my room,
and read the assigned pages of Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme. At 2:30, I left my room, and walking along one side of the oval Finney had used for my track workouts during the winter, I reached the far common, and beyond it, the gym. I went past the trophy room, downstairs into the pungent air of the locker room, changed into my gym pants, and spent an hour wrestling. I pinned my opponent once, and he pinned me once. Phil Latham showed me an involved method of escape in which you execute a modified somersault over your opponent's back. He started to talk about the accident, but I concentrated on the escape method, and the subject was dropped. Then I took a shower, dressed, and went back to the dormitory. Reread part of Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme, and at 4:45, instead of going to a scheduled meeting of the Commencement Arrangements Committee, on which I had been persuaded to take Brinker's place, I went to the infirmary. Dr. Stanpole was not patrolling the corridor, as he habitually did when he was not busy, so I sat down on the bench amid the medical smells and waited. After about 10 minutes, he came walking rapidly out of his office, his head down and his hands sunk in the pockets of his white smock. He didn't notice me until he was almost past me, and then he stopped short. His eyes met mine carefully, and I said, "Well, how is he, sir?" in a calm voice which, the moment after I had spoken, alarmed me unreasonably. Dr. Stanpole sat down next to me and put his capable-looking hand on my leg.
"This is something I think boys of your generation are going to see a lot of," he said quietly. "And I will have to tell you about it now. Your friend is dead."
He was incomprehensible. I felt an extremely cold chill along my back and neck. That was all. Dr. Stanpole went on talking incomprehensibly.
"It was such a simple, clean break. Anyone could have said it. Of course I didn't send him to Boston. Why should I?"
He seemed to expect an answer from me. So I shook my head and repeated, "Why should you?"
"In the middle of it, his heart simply stopped, without warning. I can't explain it." "Yes, I can. There's only one explanation. As I was moving the bone, some of the marrow must have escaped into his bloodstream and gone directly to his heart and stopped it. That's the only possible explanation, the only one. There are risks, there are always risks. An operating room is a place where the risks are just more formal than in other places. An operating room and in war." And I noticed that his self-control was breaking up.
"Why did it have to happen to you boys so soon? Here at Devon?"
"The marrow of his bone," I repeated aimlessly. This, at last, penetrated my mind. Phineas had died from the marrow of his bone flowing down his bloodstream to his heart. I did not cry then or ever about Finney. I did not cry even when I stood watching him being lowered into his family's straight-laced burial ground outside of Boston. I could not escape a feeling that this was my own funeral, and you do not cry in that case. Chapter 13. The quadrangle surrounding the Far Common was never considered absolutely essential to the Devon School. The essence was elsewhere, in the older, uglier, more comfortable halls enclosing the Center Common. There the school's history had unrolled, the fabled riot scenes and presidential visits and Civil War musterings, if not in these buildings, then in their predecessors on the same site. The upperclassmen and the faculty met there. The budget was compiled there. And their students were expelled. When you said Devon to an alumnus 10 years after graduation, he visualized the Center Common. The Far Common was different, a gift of the rich lady benefactress. It was Georgian, like the rest of the school, and it combined scholasticism with grace in the way which made Devon architecturally interesting. But the bricks had been laid a little too skillfully, and the woodwork was not as brittle and chipped as it should have been. It was not the essence of Devon, and so it was donated, without too serious a wrench, to the war. The Far Common could be seen from the window of my room, and early in June I stood at the window and watched the war moving in to occupy it. The advance guard, which came down the street from the railroad station, consisted of a number of jeeps, being driven with a certain restraint, their gyration-prone wheels inactive on these old ways, which offered nothing bumpier than a few cobblestones. I thought the jeeps looked noticeably uncomfortable from all the power they were not being allowed to use. There is no stage you comprehend better than the one you have just left, and as I watched the jeeps almost asserting a wish to bounce up the side of Mount Washington at 80 miles an hour instead of rolling along this dull street, they reminded me, in a comical and poignant way, of adolescence. Following them, there were some heavy trucks painted olive drab, and behind them came the troops. They were not very bellicose-looking. Their columns were straggling, their suntanned uniforms had gotten rumpled in the train, and they were singing "Roll Out the Barrel."
"What's that?"
Brinker said from behind me, pointing across my shoulder at some open trucks bringing up the rear.
"What's in those trucks?"
"They look like sewing machines."
"They are sewing machines!"
"I guess a parachute rigger school has to have sewing machines."
"If only Leper had enlisted in the Army Air Force and been assigned to parachute rigger school."
"I don't think that would have made any difference," I said. "Let's not talk about Leper."
"Leper'll be all right. There's nothing like a discharge. 2 years after the war's over, people will think a Section 8 means a berth on a Pullman car."
"Right. Now, do you mind? Why talk about something you can't do anything about?"
"Right."
I had to be right in never talking about what you could not change, and I had to make many people agree that I was right. None of them ever accused me of being responsible for what had happened to Phineas, either because they could not believe it, or else because they could not understand it. I would have talked about that, but they would not, and I would not talk about Phineas in any other way. The jeeps, troops, and sewing machines were now drawn up next to the Far Common quadrangle. There was some kind of consultation or ceremony underway on the steps of one of the buildings, Veazey Hall. The headmaster and a few of the senior members of the faculty stood in a group before the door, and a number of Army Air Force officers stood in another group within easy speaking distance of them. Then the headmaster advanced several steps and enlarged his gestures. He was apparently addressing the troops. Then an officer took his place and spoke longer and louder. We could hear his voice fairly well, but not make out the words. Around them spread a beautiful New England day. Peace lay on Devon like a blessing. The summer's peace, the reprieve, New Hampshire's response to all the cogitation and deadness of winter. There could be no urgency in work during such summers. Any parachutes rigged would be no more effective than napkins. Or perhaps that was only true of me and a few others, our gypsy band of the summer before. Or was it rarer even than that? Had Chet and Bobby sensed it then, for instance? Had Leper, despite his trays of snails? I could be certain of only two people, Phineas and myself. So now it might be true only for me. The company fell out and began scattering through the Far Common. Dormitory windows began to fly open, and olive drab blankets were hung over the sills by the dozens to air. The sewing machines were carried with considerable exertion into Veazey Hall.
"Dad's here," said Brinker. "I told him to take his cigar down to the butt room. He wants to meet you."
We went downstairs and found Mr. Hadley sitting in one of the lumpy chairs, trying not to look offended by the surroundings. But he stood up and shook my hand with genuine cordiality when we came in. He was a distinguished-looking man, taller than Brinker, so that his portliness was not very noticeable. His hair was white, thick, and healthy-looking, and his face was healthily pink.
"You boys look fine, fine,"
he said in his full and cordial voice.
"Better, I would say, than those doughboys, GIs I saw marching in. How about their artillery? Sewing machines!"
Brinker slid his fingers into the back pockets of his slacks.
"This war's so technical, they've got to use all kinds of machines, even sewing machines.
Don't you think so, Gene?
Well,
Mr. Hadley went on emphatically,
I can't imagine any man of my time settling for duty on a sewing machine. I can't picture that at all.
Then his temper switched tracks, and he smiled cordially again.
But then times change and wars change. But men don't change, do they? You boys are the image of me and my gang of the old days. It does me good to see you. What are you enlisting in, son?
He said, meaning me.
The Marines? The paratroops? There are doggone many exciting things to enlist in these days. There's that bunch they call frogmen, underwater demolition stuff. I'd give something to be a kid again with all that to choose from.
I was going to wait and be drafted, I replied, trying to be polite and answer his question honestly. But if I did that, they might put me straight in the infantry, and that's not only the dirtiest, but also the most dangerous branch of all, the worst branch of all. So I've joined the Navy, and they're sending me to Pensacola. I'll probably have a lot of training, and I'll never see a foxhole, I hope. Foxhole was still a fairly new term, and I wasn't sure Mr. Hadley knew what it meant. But I saw that he didn't care for the sound of what I said. And then Brinker, I added, is all set for the Coast Guard, which is good too. Mr. Hadley's scowl deepened, although his experienced face partially masked it.
You know, Dad, Brinker broke in, the Coast Guard does some pretty rough stuff, putting the men on the beaches, all that dangerous amphibious stuff.
His father nodded slightly, looking at the floor, and then said,
You have to do what you think is the right thing, but just make sure it's the right thing in the long run and not just for the moment. Your war memories will be with you forever. You'll be asked about them thousands of times after the war is over. People will get their respect for you from that, partly from that, don't get me wrong, but if you can say that you were up front where there was some real shooting going on, then that will mean a whole lot to you in years to come. I know you boys want to see plenty of action, but don't go around talking too much about being comfortable and which branch of the service has too much dirt and stuff like that. I know you. I feel I know Eugene as well as I know Brink here, but other people might misunderstand you. You want to serve, that's all. It's your greatest moment. Greatest privilege to serve your country. We're all proud of you. We're all, old guys like me, we're all darn jealous of you, too.
I could see that Brinker was more embarrassed by this than I was, but I felt it was his responsibility to answer it.
Well, Dad, he mumbled, we'll do what we have to. That's not a very good answer, Brink, he said in a tone struggling to remain reasonable. After all, that's all we can do. You can do more, a lot more. If you want a military record you can be proud of, you'll do a heck of a lot more than just what you have to, believe me.
Brinker sighed under his breath. His father stiffened, paused, then relaxed with an effort.
Your mother's out in the car. I'd better get back to her. You boys clean up. Those shoes,
he added reluctantly, in spite of himself having to.
Those shoes, Brink? A little polish? And we'll see you at the inn at 6.
Okay, Dad. His father left, trailing the faint, unfamiliar, prosperous aroma of his cigar.
Dad keeps making that speech about serving the country, Brinker said apologetically. I wish the hell he wouldn't.
That's all right. I knew that part of friendship consisted in accepting a friend's shortcomings, which sometimes included his parents.
I'm enlisting, he went on. I'm going to serve, as he puts it. I may even get killed, but I'll be damned if I'll have that Nathan Hale attitude of his about it. It's all that World War I malarkey that gets me. They're all children about that war. Did you ever notice?
He flopped comfortably into the chair, which had been disconcerting his father.
It gives me a pain, personally. I'm not any kind of hero, and neither are you. And neither is the old man, and he never was. And I don't care what he says he almost did at Chateau Terry.
He's just trying to keep up with the times. He probably feels left out, being too old this time.
Left out?
Brinker's eyes lighted up.
Left out? He and his crowd are responsible for it, and we're going to fight it.
I had heard this generation complaint from Brinker before,
so often that I finally identified this as the source of his disillusionment during the winter, this generalized, faintly self-pitying resentment against millions of people he did not know. He did know his father, however, and so they were not getting along well now. In a way, this was Finney's view, except that naturally, he saw it comically, as a huge, intensely practical joke, played by fat and foolish old men bungling away behind the scenes. I could never agree with either of them. It would have been comfortable, but I could not believe it, because it seemed clear that wars were not made by generations and their special stupidities, but that wars were made instead by something ignorant in the human heart. Brinker went upstairs to continue his packing, and I walked over to the gym to clean out my locker. As I crossed the far common, I saw that it was rapidly becoming unrecognizable, with huge green barrels placed at many strategic points, the ground punctuated by white markers identifying offices and areas, and also certain less tangible things, a kind of snap in the atmosphere, a professional optimism, a conscious maintenance of high morale. I myself had often been happy at Devon, but such times it seemed to me that afternoon were over now. Happiness had disappeared, along with rubber, silk, and many other staples, to be replaced by the wartime synthetic high morale for the duration. At the gym, a platoon was undressing in the locker room. The best that could be said for them physically was that they looked wiry in their startling sets of underwear, which were the color of moss. I never talked about Phineas, and neither did anyone else. He was, however, present in every moment of every day since Dr. Stanpole had told me. Finney had a vitality which could not be quenched so suddenly, even by the marrow of his bone. That was why I couldn't say anything or listen to anything about him, because he endured so forcefully that what I had to say would have seemed crazy to anyone else. I could not use the past tense, for instance. And what they had to say would be incomprehensible to me. During the time I was with him, Phineas created an atmosphere in which I continued now to live, a way of sizing up the world with erratic and entirely personal reservations, letting its rock-like facts sift through and be accepted only a little at a time, only as much as he could assimilate without a sense of chaos and loss. No one else I have ever met could do this. All others at some point found something in themselves pitted violently against something in the world around them. With those of my year, this point often came when they grasped the fact of the war, when they began to feel that there was this overwhelmingly hostile thing in the world with them. Then the simplicity and unity of their characters broke, and they were not the same again. Phineas alone had escaped this. He possessed an extra vigor, a heightened confidence in himself, a serene capacity for affection which saved him. Nothing as he was growing up at home, nothing at Devon, nothing even about the war had broken his harmonious and natural unity. So at last, I had. The parachute rigger sprinted out of the hallway toward the playing fields. From my locker, I collected my sneakers, jockstrap, and gym pants, and then turned away, leaving the door ajar for the first time. Forlornly open and abandoned, the locker unlocked. This was more final than the moment when the headmaster handed me my diploma. My schooling was over now. I walked down the aisle past the rows of lockers, and instead of turning left toward the exit leading back to my dormitory, I turned right and followed the Army Air Force out into the playing fields of Devon. A high wooden platform had been erected there, and on it stood a barking instructor, giving the rows of men below him calisthenics by the numbers. This kind of regimentation would fasten itself on me in a few weeks. I no longer had any qualms about that, although I couldn't help being glad that it would not be at Devon, anywhere like Devon, that I would have that. I had no qualms at all. In fact, I could feel now the gathering, glowing sense of sureness in the face of it. I was ready for the war, now that I no longer had any hatred to contribute to it. My fury was gone. I felt it gone. Dried up at the source, withered and lifeless. Phineas had absorbed it and taken it with him, and I was rid of it forever. The PT instructor's voice, like a frog's croak amplified 100 times, blared out the Army's numerals.
"Hut-hoo-hee-har!"
behind me as I started back toward the dormitory. And my feet, of course, could not help but begin to fall involuntarily into step with that coarse, compelling voice, which carried to me like an air raid siren across the fields and commons. They fell into step then, as they fell into step a few weeks later under the influence of an even louder voice and stronger sun. Down there, I fell into step as well as my nature, Phineas filled, would allow. I never killed anybody, and never developed an intense level of hatred for the enemy, because my war ended before I ever put on the uniform. I was on active duty all my time at school. I killed my enemy there. Only Phineas never was afraid. Only Phineas never hated anyone. Other people experienced this fearful shock somewhere, this sighting of the enemy, and so began an obsessive labor of defense, began to parry the menace they saw facing them by developing a particular frame of mind. "You see," their behavior toward everything and everyone proclaimed, "I am a humble ant. I am nothing. I am not worthy of this menace." Or else, like Mr. Ludsbury,
"How dare this threaten me? I'm much too good for this sort of handling. I shall rise above this."
Or else, like Quackenbush, "Strike out at it always and everywhere." Or else, like Brinker, develop a careless general resentment against it. Or else, like Leper, emerge from a protective cloud of vagueness, only to meet it, the horror, face to face, just as he had always feared, and so give up the struggle absolutely. All of them, all except Phineas, constructed at infinite cost to themselves these Maginot lines against this enemy they thought they saw across the frontier, this enemy who never attacked that way, if he ever attacked at all, if he was, indeed, the enemy.
You have been enjoying an audio bookshelf production of A Separate Piece by John Knowles and narrated by Scott Snively. For more information on this or any other audio bookshelf production, call 1-800-234-1713. Go online to audiobookshelf.com or write Audio Bookshelf, 174 Prescott Hill Road, Northport, Maine, 04849. A Separate Piece, copyright 1959 by John Knowles. A Separate Piece recording copyright 2002, Audio Bookshelf. Used by permission of Curtis Brown Limited, New York, New York. All rights reserved. Copying this production for any reason is strictly forbidden.